We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. We do have quorum. Representative Howe, you want to move the minutes today?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes from March 30th.
Representative Howe moves the minutes from March 30th. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the March 30th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Welcome, Representative McNamara. We have House File 2841. I'm going to move your bill, House File 2841, to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. To that, Representative McNamara, if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are before your committee today. This is the effort to follow up on last year where we found out the Metropolitan Landfill account is not invested. This bill simply allows it to be invested for long-term gain through the State Board of Investment, which is under the purview of this committee, and I would stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, in your packets, you do have the fiscal note. Ms. Roberts, do you want to just briefly walk through the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, you can see on page 3 is the portion from the State Board of Investment, which is the agency under this committee's purview, and they discussed that the cost to invest the assets would be approximately one basis point of the assets, and those costs would be deducted directly from the account, and the total annual cost will depend on the assets under management. And then there's some further discussion under the portion of the Pollution Control Administration, or agency, which is showing an impact to the remediation fund. And I don't know if there's anyone here from the agency that might want to shed some light on that.
Well, that's not part of our purview, okay. So we'll just deal with the investment board that was addressed elsewhere. Do we have, members, any questions on this bill at all? Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I am going to renew my motion that House File 2841 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill goes to Ways and Means.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Representative McNamara.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I understand you have a guest here today.
I actually have the honor to have my only daughter here, my daughter Melanie, who's completing her master's in instructional design at St. Cloud State University. So she's sitting in the audience and watching what Dad does on a day-to-day basis. And I'm sure she'll report back to Mom.
Good.
You could stand up and say hi. So with that, I believe we have House File 2913. Representative Yassaro? Yeruso Safari?
Yep. I've got a couple people coming up.
So we're just...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My presenters have a PowerPoint to get geared up here, so did you move the bill already?
Representative Yassaro, we're not going to move the bill. We're just going to hear the bill,
okay,
and then it'll, because it's a bonding bill.
Right. Thank you. So good morning, and thank you for hearing this. This is HF 2913 for a project in my district. This is for... building a new state emergency operations center. And I'm just going to give you kind of context for where this is, and then I'll let my testifiers take over as far as the details of the project. So currently the emergency operations center is located in downtown St. Paul. This is located in Arden Hills, and it is on the northern edge of what is known as the TCAP property, the Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant. That's a 2 mile by 2 mile square area, and the first thing I want to clarify is that this is not to be located in the part of that property that was purchased by Ramsey County for redevelopment. There's that was only a small piece of the property. There's a substantial amount of the property that's still owned by the Army and used by the Reserve and the National Guard. There's a MnDOT property up on this on the northern edge of the TCAP, and it would be close to that. It would have good access to 35W and Highway 10, and it also would be able to make use of the adjoining property that's used for the training facility, the military training facility there. One of the good aspects of this project is that it does not take any non-public land out of circulation, because the proposal is to be located on surplus federal land. And the other good part about that is that it's for $0 and 0 cents to get hold of that land. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Urusso. And could you just welcome to the committee, Commissioner, and state your name and introduce yourself to the committee, and let's go with the presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Urusso. For the record, my name is Mona Doman. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and seated to my left is Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Joe Kelly. We appreciate the opportunity to present to you the proposal that we have put together for the site development, design, construction, furnishing, and equipping of the new State Emergency Operations Center and office for our Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Our proposal is included in the Governor's in Governor Dayton's bonding bill, and this proposal is a request for $33.3 million. And in a moment, Director Kelly will speak to the specifics of the proposal. As you well know, the people of Minnesota depend on all of us to respond in times of disaster. DPS's Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division is the coordination center for state agencies and partner organizations supporting Minnesota communities during disasters. We all come together to the center when the natural or man-made disaster strikes one of our communities or regions. We come together to coordinate state resources that support our local partners across the state. This is one of our core functions, to support local governments when it hits their community, their county, or their region. Disasters take on different forms and can strike anywhere in the state. As an example, in the past 5 years since I've been with the Department of Public Safety, our center has been activated at some level for probably 400 emergencies, some small and some larger, like the tornado that struck Minneapolis, or the devastating storm that struck the Brainerd Lakes area last summer, to train derailments or avian flu, or the Ebola scare, or spring flooding in all parts of the state. Events like these have touched every part of the state. Regardless of where they strike, people in the communities depend on us to make sure we coordinate the state agency response, and that is what we do at the State Emergency Operations Center. The need for a new State Emergency Operations Center continues to grow, and Director Kelly will give you the overview of our proposal in just a minute. We greatly appreciate your time and look forward to working with you on this investment for Minnesota. And I'll now turn it over to Director Kelly to give you the specifics on the project.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to brief you on this important public safety project. And I'm going to start by quickly explaining what we do in the State Emergency Operations Center. All emergencies and disasters, all incidents are local. They begin on a road or in a neighborhood of a city, a township, or a county. You may have been involved and provided leadership during such instances. When the requirements to respond and recover from such events are beyond the capacity of local government to deal with, they call on the state for assistance. When that type of incident happens, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety implements our state emergency operations plan, and we activate the State Emergency Operations Center, or as we refer to it, the state EOC. Representatives from more than two dozen state agencies, multiple volunteer organizations, the federal government, and others assemble in the EOC to coordinate that assistance to our communities. For large incidents, the number of people working in the state EOC may approach 200. We think it would be totally unacceptable if state government could not answer those calls for help, and that is why we need a dependable State Emergency Operations Center. There's a common misperception that the state EOC sits cold, dark, and quiet until an emergency happens, whereas quite the opposite is true. HSEM's offices and the state EOC are very busy, multi-purpose facilities. During the last 5 years, the EOC has hosted more than 2,800 different events, not counting our daily office activities. It has been activated for disaster response for 408 days since 2010. It is also heavily used for training, exercising, meetings, conferences, and media events. It is a very busy place that a lot of different folks use, even without emergencies. To be dependable, the State Emergency Operations Center must have all the attributes on that slide. Available means that it is located outside of risk areas and will not be affected by severe weather. Operational means that it has effective, reliable, and redundant infrastructure like power and communications. Functional means it's properly sized and has the required operating features. Secure means we can control access to it and protect its critical functions. Our current facility falls short for all of these factors, presenting risk to our ability to support local and state governments during emergencies. As Commissioner Doman mentioned, our current state EOC is located in St. Paul at the Town Square Complex, which, if you've been there, is a very busy, mixed-use, and densely developed downtown area. Mm-hmm. Among the more alarming deficiencies is that we sit right on top of a public underground parking ramp. The floor of our operations center, where we provide this support to local government during emergencies, is actually the ceiling of a parking ramp of which we have no ability to control access to. Mm-hmm. Our street-level exterior wall, and that's the one you see in the picture, is a mere 12 feet from the light rail line. And that wall that you see there is very soft. It's essentially plate glass, a little bit of framing, and some sheetrock. So there really is no protection from the street level. We have single feeds for power and communications. Our backup generator is old, unreliable, and very expensive to maintain. And because we're in the lower level of a downtown high-rise building, our options for alternate communications like satellite and line-of-sight radios are severely limited. We have no ability to secure the approaches to the facility. Quite literally, our doors are our first and last access barriers. If you walk out our front door, you go about 15 paces and you're at a Jimmy John's, and you go another 5 paces, you're at a Caribou Coffee. It's along a public walkway through the skyways of St. Paul. One morning, we discovered that an intruder had slept in our conference room. So these shortcomings and many more are, we think, unacceptable for a one-of-a-kind, critical, no-fail public safety and continuity of government facility that the people of Minnesota are counting on. We lease 20,000 square feet currently. With inadequate power and communications and network infrastructure for just under half a million dollars a year. A couple key points to make. During the pre-design process for a new facility, the architects calculated our space requirements. They looked at our mission, our functional areas, the number of people that we have both during the during normal times, office operations, as well as during activations for emergencies. And they calculated our space requirements at more than 65,000 square feet. And like I said, we're currently renting 20,000 square feet downtown. Now, we have reduced the scope of the project to just over 52,000 by leveraging our partnership with the Department of Military Affairs and taking advantage of the adjacent National Guard facilities in Arden Hills when we need them. So there's some significant space that we will not have to build because of the location and because of our partnership with the National Guard. Second, using industry cost factors, it would only cost about 10% more to operate and maintain that much larger and more capable proposed facility. In other words, for an additional $50,000 a year, we would have a dependable facility more than 2.5 times larger than our current space. Our annual square foot cost would drop from approximately $24.50 to $7.70, a reduction of about 68%. Additionally, you would be investing in a state asset instead of paying rent. The investment in this project, as the commissioner mentioned, is $33.3 million, and as members may know, this is not a new issue. The legislature previously appropriated money with which we completed the pre-design work. We also conducted a legislatively directed study to confirm Arden Hills as the location for this facility, and we are now ready to move forward with the design and construction of a dependable new State Emergency Operations Center. And here's the cost breakdown. As Representative Russo mentioned, the building site is on federal land, excess federal land that will be transferred to the state at no cost. Funds for the design and pre-construction services had been previously appropriated but were canceled at the end of 2014. So we are very grateful for the introduction of House File 2913 to appropriate bond proceeds for a new State Emergency Operations Center. We would like to thank the following organizations for their support of this project: the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and the members of the Minnesota Fire Advisory Committee, which includes the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire Department Association, Fire Marshal Association, and others. So, Mr. Chair and members, thank you again for this opportunity, and we await your questions.
Thank you, Director Kelly, and I don't know who wants to take this question from me, but if it's Commissioner Doman or Director Kelly, but how could you explain to the committee exactly who all, what other state agencies play a role in the EOC, and who has a seat at the table?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I don't have them committed to memory. They are spelled out in the governor's executive order that assigns emergency responsibilities to state agencies. But they include most of the primary state agencies that provide support to our communities: the Minnesota Department of Health, Department of Military Affairs, Department of Transportation, a number of the divisions within the Department of Public Safety, like the Fire Marshal, the State Patrol, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Department of Education, Department of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources, many, many others who, when we activate the State Emergency Operations Center and our emergency plan, send representatives, and usually it's one or two people from each of those agencies, that come to the Emergency Operations Center to represent the resources of their department.
Thank you, Director Kelly. And are there any other state agencies that would probably benefit from co-locating there instead of renting their own facilities?
Mr. Chair and members, we have contemplated that from a Department of Public Safety perspective. This project is specific to the Department or the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, but certainly with roughly 20 acres up there, there's room for expansion should the legislature decide to appropriate funding for further expansion to house other divisions within the Department of Public Safety. That could be an option in the future.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, because what strikes me is having played a role in emergency management in the past and served in the National Guard at some of these state emergencies. I find it, probably helpful to probably locate both the state fire marshal's office there because they lease space. Possibly the, I know there was a plan to put the headquarters of the National Guard there at one time. I think on the very site that you have selected for this, it must be a popular site. So I was just thinking that hopefully that there's a plan to expand and possibly coordinate with them because I think it would be extremely helpful to have those folks across the hall with availability. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons that the site is looked at for a variety of those things and why MnDOT's there is because this is the northern edge that's right along County Road I that then has access to 35W. So that row along along County Road I is not fully occupied and won't be with this project either.
Thank you, and I've swatted a few mosquitoes during training exercises, so I know the facility well.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
I bet you have. For the members of the committee, if I could just sort of explain, if you're not aware, and we'd love to have you come to our building. Well, it's not our building; it's the Bremer Bank building. But the Department of Public Safety, the bulk of the divisions are housed in the Bremer Bank building on different floors. Our Office of Justice Programs is on the 23rd floor. The Commissioner's Office is on the 10th floor. The State Patrol and HSEM are in the basement. Fiscal Administrative Services, State Fire Marshal, Alcohol and Gambling, we're kind of spread all over the Bremer Bank building. And so it does lead to some challenges when you're working, you know, together to have to travel around that building. So that's a conversation we've contemplated, just not part of this specific project at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Kelly. I had several years in the reserve working in the intel area and working in secure facilities. And how secure is this facility going to be in terms of getting in and out of the facility?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, it will be secure to the degree that there will be multiple access points that you have to go through. In other words, there'll be a fenced perimeter that will have access control, as well as then into the building and then into the critical areas such as the Emergency Operations Center floor. So to get to the critical function the state agency is performing during an activation, I'd say there'll be at least three levels of security, three rings.
Follow-up, Representative.
Mr. Chair, and a couple of years ago I went up to Camp Ripley, and we have a facility up there that was just constructed in the last few years. And at that point they said that this could be our OAS Operations Center. Is that still in the works there as being a backup, or could it actually be our operations center?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, that facility is under the management of the Minnesota National Guard. It was constructed and equipped primarily as a training facility. So it does not have all of the functionality, all the redundancy that this facility would have. Our alternate state emergency operations center is in the New Brighton Public Safety Center that the state made an investment in when that was constructed. I view the facility at Camp Ripley that you're referring to, sir, as kind of a tertiary or an auxiliary. So when we look at if we had to leave downtown St. Paul and New Brighton wasn't adequate, that would probably be one of the first places that we would consider going to Camp Ripley, to the Emergency Management Training Center.
Okay. Representative Governor. Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to Director Kelly or Commissioner Dillman or Representative Russo, a couple questions for you. Wanted to ask first, how does this interface with some of the county emergency management centers, because Carver County is a fairly well-developed emergency management system, and I just didn't hear that in the testimony, how that would work together. So that's one question, and I'll, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'll have a few others.
Well,
Representative
Russo, but we do have to move the bill along because we got a few others to go through.
It's quick. The Ramsey County Emergency Operations Center is 2 miles to the south, and so there would be a pretty easy coordination of training efforts and whatnot with Ramsey County in particular. And it's very close to the Anoka County border. I don't know offhand where Anoka County's center is, but it's 1 mile from the Anoka County border.
And Mr. Chair, Director Kelly, would you like to...
Mr. Chair and Representative, to add to Representative Russo's comments, our primary customers, if you will, to use that word, are the county emergency management directors. And during an emergency, our primary communications links and how we provide that state assistance is through those county emergency operations centers, like the one you're referring to in Carver County. And because we have one location, that's why our communications infrastructure and having it be reliable and redundant is so critical, because in each county that may be affected by a storm, and I would tell you 2 years ago we had a declaration that involved 37 counties and three tribal governments, we are communicating directly with each of those counties through their emergency operations center.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. To the testifiers as well, I see that your budget for IT services is $3.5 million, and just trying to understand how are you going to be working with Minute? Because $3.5 million seems awfully low to stand up a new system in a new building and actually have things like cybersecurity and others. Just questioning, has that been gone through in great detail? Because it seems like a rather scant budget to handle IT infrastructure.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is the wiring and some of the hard infrastructure, if you will, to include the construction of data centers and such are included in the building cost. The $3.3 million is kind of what I would say are for like endpoint screens, monitors, things of that nature. So a lot of the infrastructure cost for IT and communications is in the building cost. The $3.3 million is for the endpoint, the devices, if you will, from a glass wall to phones and computers.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, if you could wrap this up,
yeah,
please.
So this doesn't involve cybersecurity, doesn't involve actually any of the back end, it's all just hardware?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to my understanding, correct, because we would still be protected by Minute.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kelly, good morning. I note in your slide that talks about availability, and then you mentioned operational, and I'm looking at the detail for the budget itself. And I note you're looking at a standard office building, but then you're moving on to such terms as hardening and redundancy. Sounds like we're building a bunker, and that's fine. I understand that, but to the extent that we are making sure that someone or something doesn't prevail upon us, I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on systems redundancy, the defensive posture that we might take for not only a contingency of weather, because that is what probably most people consider when they contemplate a natural or statewide disaster. But how would you go about, and are you contemplating such things as an EMP event or a biohazard contingency, or just candidly a full frontal assault on the building itself from enemy combatants?
And Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, good morning. And it is an expensive building. I don't want to say we're building a bunker, but we are building a hardened building and a redundant building. So not all of those costs are in hardening. Just a few of the details, for structural system, it is conceived as being a poured concrete basic structure with tilt-up precast panels, hurricane glass. The roof would be redundant, in other words, two roofs with a separate membrane that would be strapped on. But then more to your point, or in addition to your point, a lot of mechanical system and electrical system redundancy. Two feeds for power and communications, backup generators, redundant fire suppression, those kinds of things. So when we look at it, we considered all the threats and applied the Department of Defense's anti-terrorism force protection standards to the building construction, standoff from, if you will, from parking lots and the rest of it. We have done our best within the limits of the resources available, tried to account for all those without turning it in, without turning it into a bunker.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either the Commissioner or Mr. Kelly. My curiosity is a very short question. With the current facility with so many shortcomings and deficiencies, what made that the best choice at the time for us to put it in there?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll keep this as brief as I can, but I think it's useful to go one position, one location back from where we are now, which as members may recall, the Division of Emergency Management and the State Emergency Operations Center used to be in the basement of the Capitol in room B5. And during the catastrophic floods of 1997, when we actually got all of those agencies that we talked about earlier, and had the federal government and volunteer organizations, one of my predecessors, Jim Franklin, realized he did not have the room to operate. So we had to very quickly move them into the fifth floor of the Veterans Service Building. And I think when after that activation ended, Mr. Franklin looked at that and said, wow, we got to do something different. So they looked for available retail rental space in downtown St. Paul to keep it proximate to the Capitol area. And came upon 20,000 square feet in Town Square. You know, a couple things have happened since 1997. One would be 9/11. So the Homeland Security part of our business caused our organization to grow. And the second is we've just had an increased instance of disasters. Most of them, thankfully, all of them, natural disasters. We've received 19 presidential disaster declarations, major disaster declarations in the last 10 years. So the short answer is we had to move quickly because the space that they had at the time was unacceptable. They found something that was much better than they had, but then 9/11 and increased disaster activity, we have outgrown it. And what I don't want to do is end up being like Jim Franklin in the future saying when something major happens, realizing how poor the current facility we have so that we end up having to scramble again like they did almost 20 years ago.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Just one follow-up, and just a comment. 9/11 is 14 years ago, and to now come to say that we have some deficiencies in security seems a little bit late. So I would just inquire of the department to be proactive again. I appreciate that.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, this is not the first time we've carried the bill and brought it forward. And to the Camp Ripley question point before, this proposed facility is approximately 14 miles from the Capitol. It would take about 25 minutes for the various people from the agencies to be able to gather there from their current offices in St. Paul. So that's one of the advantages over going farther outstate with that.
Thank you. Members, we're way over this, but Representative Carlson?
I'll pass in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you in the vicinity of MnDOT's facility there? I think they've got a dispatch, 9/11 emergency dispatch type operation. Are you going to tie in with them, or is this another?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Yuri.
Yes, the MnDOT facility is practically next door.
Mr. Chairman, is that going to be tied in with this, or no? Is that going to stand, it's a standalone operation?
Representative Yuri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that depends on the extent to which you mean tied in, because this facility is going to be an independent, secure facility, but in proximity to the facility you're talking about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a fairly new facility. I remember touring that not too long ago, and they were showing us all the new equipment and the new operators and all that.
Mr. Chair.
You represent Urusa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on the bus with you that time 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So they had to bring us to the MnDOT facility because, of course, there wasn't anything to show for this facility. So you're correct. It's right next door, but it doesn't perform all the functions that we've described today.
Well, one more question, Mr. Chairman. If we're ready to make this secure, are you far enough away from a nuclear blast in Central City here? You doing any good?
Mr. Chair.
Right now, you're so.
Well, I mean, let's plan ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Urso.
I don't think they want to locate the facility out of the state.
Any final comments?
Thank you very much for hearing the bill. I hope that you can support this. I think that it's a very appropriate effort in the continuing repurposing of the site that served us in World War II. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Urso. Commissioner Dolman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Just briefly, I would just offer if any other members have additional questions that we couldn't cover today, please, we'll avail ourselves to any of those.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming to our committee and presenting the bill, and I hope that we could co-locate a number of facilities there and make it very usable for all of us. Thank you for coming to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For House file.
It's a bonding request.
Pardon? 3068. I see Representative Murphy's going to present the Northeast Regional Correction Center. Welcome to the committee, Representative Murphy, and if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Metzen is in another committee with the bill, and so I generously offered my time to come to this committee and tell you about the work farm. That's what it was called as I was growing up in our area. Lake and Cook and St. Louis and Carlton and Coochaching County make up the Northeastern Minnesota Regional Correction Facility group, a collaborative. And the 3,000 acres at the NERC provides people that are sentenced there productive days and saves money for the people there, for the state, because the Northeastern Regional Correction Facility exists. Kay Arala is the director of the NERC, and she will tell you all the details of 3068 that you need to know.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself to the committee and go on with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kay Arala, and I'm the director of Arrowhead Regional Corrections.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to present our project and ask for your support. Arrowhead Regional Corrections is a joint powers agency that was formed under the Community Corrections Act in 1976. And the five member counties are those that Representative Murphy has already identified. So we serve a huge region of the state. We provide all of the correctional services to those five counties, and one of those services is that we own and operate the Northeast Regional Correction Center, or as we affectionately call it, NERC. NERC is a 144-bed correctional facility for adult men. It has all of the traditional correctional services that you would expect. We have an outstanding education program. We offer chemical dependency treatment. We have mental health services, medical services, cognitive skills programming. But what makes NERC unique is that those correctional services are being offered in a farm environment. We are actually a working farm. We are located on 3,200 acres north of Duluth in Saginaw, Minnesota, so about 15 miles north of Duluth, and we farm about 800 of those acres. We grow a variety of crops at NERC. We grow hay and barley We use some of that, and the rest we sell. It is one of our revenue sources. We grow all kinds of vegetables, carrots, potatoes, onions, cucumbers, potatoes. We also raise some livestock. So we raise chickens, turkeys, and pigs. Everything that we produce at NERC, we use to feed the men and offset our expenses for food. So when a man comes to NERC to serve his sentence, not only is he connected with the correctional programs that he needs, but he is assigned to a work crew. We have indoor maintenance crews, outdoor maintenance crews. We have men who are working in the kitchen, learning food safety and proper food service skills. We have men who work with our auto mechanic in maintaining our farm equipment and vehicles. And a large number of the men work in the farm operation. So the men are actually taking care of our livestock. They are working in the greenhouse year-round. This time of year, we're starting to prepare for them to do the planting. They maintain the fields, and they also harvest in the fall. The other thing that we have at NERC that is very unique is that we have a meat processing facility. So some of the men learn meat cutting and butchering skills. In the fall, well, year-round, we are processing chickens. But in the fall, we are processing our hogs and our turkeys. And so the men are also learning that skill. So this is, there is no other NERC in the state of Minnesota. And we even struggle to find a similar model anywhere in the country. It is just that unique. But that's not the real story of NERC. The story of NERC is that it seems to be an effective deterrent. We measure our recidivism rate, and about 83% of the men who serve their sentence at NERC do not commit felony offenses for 3 years from discharge. And that's a pretty standard recidivism definition used not only statewide but nationally. So that compares to an average recidivism rate in Minnesota for incarcerated population of about 66%. So for a variety of reasons, we know that this is an effective model. Our request is for $2.85 million, and this is really to continue in the investment that we have already made to preserving the assets that we have at NERC. This facility was in dire need of investment in capital improvements. And to date, those five counties have invested over $7 million in the last 3 years, primarily focusing on renovating and updating the main building. And the main building houses the men. It has food services. It has our admin build offices and some of the programming space. But NERC is made up, our campus has 42 buildings, and they are all in various stages of disrepair. This proposal would address 14 of those buildings, including all three of the barns. So the barns where we house the chickens, turkeys, and pigs, they all need roofs. We have our mechanics building and a root cellar that need proper exhaust and ventilation systems. We have buildings that need more energy-efficient heating. We have been working on this project for 3 years. We have had to do that incrementally because we have remained open throughout this project. We continue to house and serve these men while we do the renovations. And so we are asking that you support this project once again. We are midstream, but we are not done. NERC is an important asset to not only northeastern Minnesota, but I would say to the state of Minnesota. In our region, it's a huge region, those five counties, and men come from all five of those counties to serve their time at NERC. Two of our counties, St. Louis County and Carleton County, are currently experiencing jail overcrowding issues, and so they are housing offenders out in neighboring jails. That makes these 144 beds critical to the criminal justice needs in our region. But I also think these beds are important to the state of Minnesota. You, and I know this is not news to you, but you are experiencing a prison overcrowding issue and are also housing prisoners out in local county jails. The more work that we can do with these offenders at NERC, and over 75% of them are convicted felons, the better job that we do, the less likely it is that they will become a state prisoner. And so I believe that we bring great value to the state of Minnesota. So I want to thank you for your time this morning. I want to thank you for your past support of NERC, and just remind you that this is an ongoing project and that we are not at the finish line yet, and we really need the state support to continue to make our progress.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have a few questions, and I just remind folks that we are behind the clock. So Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say that basically you have a 17% recidivism rate? Because you said 83 don't?
83 do not
correct.
And the statewide is which?
66% do not.
Do not. Okay.
Correct.
I think it's excellent. I love this idea. We should not be just putting people. It's sort of like raising the chickens here. We put them in little cages, or we put them in a natural setting. They thrive or they don't. I love this.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Blumen.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And I want to congratulate you on the success of this program. This is an impressive presentation. My question has to do with budgeting. When you do your budgeting for the program, do you have deferred maintenance factored in?
Correct.
We have failed to do that on a consistent basis over the past decades, and that is one of the reasons that this facility has fallen into disrepair and needed such an infusion of money. I would say that the 2000s, the recession, were a very difficult time for counties, and we had to maintain our staffing levels and the program, and what failed to be met probably were those investments in capital.
Representative Blumenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one final question. Have you budgeted for your upcoming fiscal cycle?
We...
Director.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We will start working on our 17 budget, and that's due to our board in July and approved in August.
And that is reported to whom?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The budget is the responsibility of the Arrowhead Regional Corrections Board, which is made up of 8 elected commissioners from each of those 5 counties.
And I would just request, Chairman, that we get a copy of that when we're considering this proposal. It's an important asset. I'm with you there. But the long term, there's a way to be proactive about some of this, and I think that's important.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. And I'm sure that she could make that available to us. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in what happens if one of the, I'll call them clients, going through a vocational program doesn't quite complete the program while they're incarcerated. Do you have relationships with other training institutions then where they have a transition into, let's say, a tech college or some other vocational training facility? The reason I ask that question, Mr. Chairman, is that I do know, for example, St. Cloud, which is a much larger operation, if you're in one of their vocational training programs and you're released before you're done with the training, they have relationships through with some of the Minsky institutions so that they can continue and complete their training. And I'm just interested in that part of it, because you seem to be quite successful, but I'm looking at things down the road once they're released.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have some of those linkages in place, and we do have a vocational counselor that's on staff in our education program. We don't have the formalized relationship that St. Cloud has. Most of our vocational programming right now is limited in time frame, knowing that these are offenders that can by statute, they can only serve 8 months at NERC, so much shorter sentencing times than in a prison setting. So we scale our vocational training to shorter term.
And Ms. Chen, that's why I raised the question, because I did a tour of the facility, and I remember it is short term, and I was assuming that there might be certain vocational programs where in 8 months they're not necessarily able to complete the program, and I don't know if any of the programs are geared to eventual licensure or not, but at any rate, I was interested in that question, because if they finish the program and can be mainstreamed into whatever that training is, it would be helpful, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Earhart.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Is this facility supplied any money by the RRB, or are they online? Could they possibly receive some funds from them?
Director, who wants to take that question? Director Arroa or... or Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, that the area that NERC is in geographically is not part of the IRRB geographical area, or okay, the school districts that belong to that the IRRB covers.
Thank you.
So that makes it, Mr. Chairman, not eligible then, is that what we're saying?
That would be correct.
Thank you.
That would be correct. Seeing no other questions, Representative Johnson, did you have a question? Or
not? Thank you, Mr. Chair, not to this bill, but I was going to ask Chair Anderson to yield for just a couple brief questions when you're done with the bill.
Okay, she'll be coming up. So I thank you for the presentation. Thank you for presenting to our committee, and I'm sure we'll see this. The bonding bill will be taken up there, so... appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. I should have offered you final comments, Representative Murphy, if you have any.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I.
Representative Johnson, did you want to ask your question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hoping that you can provide the committee here with a roadmap toward the markup and completion of the committee's omnibus bill. And I have several questions in that regard. I know several finance committees have already begun the process. And so my questions are, when do you plan to submit an omnibus bill to committee for consideration? Secondly, how far in advance will we receive your initial recommendations so we can draft amendments and prepare our side of the aisle here? And then lastly, when will we know what the fiscal target is for the committee's bill? So those are the three main questions I have, and any guidance you can give us would be appreciated.
Sure, and thanks for the questions, Representative Johnson. I haven't been given any targets myself. I don't know if we're going to have a target or not. As you know, that this is not a budget year, so any target would be from a supplementary nature. So I haven't been given any of that. So I can only share with you the information that I have myself. And so that, of course, dictates whether we have an omnibus bill or not. If we don't have a target, we don't have an omnibus bill. As far as amendments, as you know, our committee does not have a rule or a deadline on amendments, so you would be given that opportunity as soon as the bill is posted. Any other questions?
I have no other questions at this time.
Great. With that, members, we're going to go on to the review of federal funds. I asked Ms. Roberts to look into this issue. We received, boy, how many days ago now? About 11 days ago, we received from, was it the governor's office or was it just the agencies? I think it was governor's, MMB. We received a letter from MMB with a list of all the different agencies in the state that receive federal funds. And then they're required by Minnesota statute to give that notification to the legislature, and then the legislature can determine whether or not they're going to have those funds put in, they remain in the general fund, or if we allocate them to the different agencies on there. So what I saw out of all of those agencies, the one that's under our purview is the Human Rights Agency. That's part of our budget. And so I asked staff to look into this issue, and Ms. Roberts has done some research for me on this issue, and I thought I would throw it to Ms. Roberts at this point, if you can kind of explain kind of the process of federal funds, how we've handled it historically, and so forth. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members, as you noted, you did receive a federal funds review request for the Department of Human Services or Human Rights for an amount of $575,000 each year beginning in fiscal year 2016. And under the federal funds review process, since this was submitted under Minnesota statutes 3.3005, the legislature has 20 days to review this request. And if you wish to review the request, the agency cannot spend the funds until the request for further review is satisfied, the request is approved in legislation, or the legislature has adjourned. As I discussed with you, when we received this, the first thing that I did was go back and look at the governor's budget from 2015 to see if there was a federal funds table submitted with that request, and there was not. So,
Chair, do we have a handout for following this? Or?
No, I've just asked Ms. Roberts to provide us the information verbally. So what we hope to do is when we kind of get this all together, I'll be sending out information to all the members. But this is kind of more of a informational hearing, if you will, a kind of a learning process. I'm sure Representative Kahn and Representative Carlson, and probably yourself too, Representative Hearhart, have experienced this. This is something that I just haven't tracked, and so I thought it would be helpful for the committee to kind of learn about the process.
Thank you.
Ms. Roberts.
So in further conversations with the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget staff, we discovered that this is actually a new request for the department in terms of the past practices. The department has for decades had an ongoing work-sharing agreement with the federal government, the EEOC, and the state has received federal payments to reimburse the department for that work. And up until very recently, those federal payments were deposited in the general fund. And this request that has come in recently would allow the department to retain those federal funds and spend them within the agency's budget. So that is a change from recent practice. And that's something that I think that MMB and the department would probably have to explain the dialogue that they had about that change. I did do some research on the funding arrangement and how federal funds flowed, and it actually, the changes go back to the early 1980s. So prior to fiscal year 1985, the Department of Human Rights retained those federal payments within their budget, which is similar to what they're asking for now. In the early 1980s, it's clear that the legislature had several conversations about the department. And we can go back and look. There was an OLA program evaluation in 1981 and then a follow-up in 1983 that discusses these issues. There's also a biennial report from the Department of Human Rights for 1983 to 1984 that also discusses these issues. And the outcome was first in the 1983 session, the legislature increased the appropriations to the department. And then again, in the 1984 session, a supplemental year, they again increased the appropriations to the department to cover the concerns about resources and the reliance on federal funds. And so the change in 1984 essentially was to say, we don't want you to rely on federal funds and how that changes your priorities. The federal funds will now be deposited in the general fund, but we're increasing, the agency's general fund budget was increased to cover those loss of federal funds. And I have a copy of the 1984 legislation if that would be helpful.
If the page would hand those out, that would be helpful.
So that has been the practice since fiscal year 1985, is that the federal payments that come in to reimburse the department for its work were deposited in the general fund. And then the part that I think we need some additional information from is sometime in the last year, there was a discussion between MMB and the department about this arrangement. And my understanding is that at this point, the federal funds have not been deposited in the general fund, and there was an adjustment made in the November forecast, but they also are not available to the department to spend. And that's why the department is coming through this federal funds process to get approval to spend those funds.
And I do see that we have Commissioner Lindsay's folks here. Commissioner Lindsay, yourself, I don't know if you want to come down or if you want to have one of your staff handle it, but if you wouldn't mind, we would like to get some clarification on this. Welcome, Commissioner. So the question that we have before you is kind of when did the conversations take place between your office and then MMB on this, and kind of how did that all take place? Can you help us out on kind of filling in the blanks here?
Sure. Welcome, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So in reviewing the EEOC contract, it has respective language concerning how funds should be received and used by the federal or by the recipient entity, which would be the Department of Human Rights, as relates to the terms of the EEOC contract. They indicate that the funds which are received by the EEOC should be used for the express purposes of carrying out the respective contract, and they are to be used for investigating charges of discrimination which are processed by the department. When an individual brings a claim to the EEOC and they believe that there are state law claims that are still valid under the EEOC, we go over to the EEOC and we review secondarily those matters which have been investigated by the EEOC to see if there's any state law claims which survive. And then also education outreach efforts between the EEOC and the Department of Human Rights. And in looking at that language, I then asked MMB as relates to how funds had been allocated, because under the language within the EEOC contract, it would suggest to me that all of the funds should be retained by the department.
And Commissioner Lindsay, what was the time frame of that conversation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to be honest, I can't tell you with specificity as relates to the date. Given the amount as relates to which has been put into this escrowed account, we could probably calculate back out and give you a rough approximation as relates to when the conversation would have happened.
Can you give me like a month? Was it July? Was it, you know, prior to then? Or can you give me a ballpark figure, basically?
Oh, it's been more than a year.
More than a year. Okay. And then, Commissioner, a couple other things, too. What is the minimum maintenance of effort from the feds?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not familiar with the term maintenance of effort. Could you define that?
Okay. No, that's fine. I'll probably talk to you offline on that then. Can you also tell me, so you have the funds, the $575,000, you haven't spent that, you haven't committed that to anything at this point, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Members, any other questions for Commissioner Lindsay while we have him here? All right, and if you can just get back to us, I think it would be helpful to kind of get a more ballpark figure of when the conversation took place and kind of what was involved in that, that would be helpful for us.
Sure, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. So you want me to get back and to you as it relates to the time frame. Is there any other information that you would like concerning that?
I think that you and I probably could probably sit down and discuss some other issues that I have.
So. That would be fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, members, we are adjourned.